It's good to be here, and what a good-looking group. Aren't there any seats left back there? You all out of seats? Wow. Where are you guys parking? You know, this is like the, it's like Grand Central Station in here. A couple people came up to me about recording the meeting, wanted to record it, and the meetings, all the meetings that we've had here have been recorded, and they're all on rocketed.org. www.rocketed, rocketed.org. So you don't have to worry about recording anything. They're all there. So, so this is, I was driving down here and thinking about planning. You know, during the, what I do is as I drive down here for, during the 5 minutes before I get here, I start planning what I might say. And I had actually quickly devised the greatest six-step meeting you guys would ever hear. I was amazed at the profound insights on the fifth step that I was going to speak about tonight. And then I walked in here and somebody told me I was actually on step four. And then somebody else told me, he says, no, I think you're on step five. And thus the effect I have on, you know, people who are watching or listening to this deal. And so this will probably be sort of like a step six meeting. But I'm going to package it as a step five meeting. You know, I'll wrap it in a step five packaging. And you won't know the difference. It'll be okay. It'll all work. It's just going to be an AA meeting, you know what I mean? I don't think anybody's going to drink during it, hopefully. You know what I mean? And well, you know, the truth is with these steps, you know, as I said, I'm a member, by the way, of the Carl Gables group. I want to say that. I think it's very important to be a member of a group. Join a home group. My sponsor told me, he said he wants you, when I asked him to be a sponsor, he said, look, there's just a couple things I'm going to ask you to do. He says, number one, if you're going to drink, call me up before you drink. Don't call me up afterwards. I don't really care. And the second thing was, he said he wanted me to read the 24-hour book every day and ask God's help to stay sober. And of course, the third thing is, he said he wanted me to join a home group. How important it was to join a home group. And I'm going to talk a little bit about that. All that sort of has to do with the fifth step in a certain way. And, I think I've told you guys the story. Oh, by the way, there's, as many as you know, there's the Cross Florida conference and concert going on this weekend at the First Presbyterian Church, 609 Brickell Avenue, today. It's going to be incredible, but I just want you guys to know that the concert on Saturday night that starts at 8 o'clock with Kathleen Carnelli, which is great, is going to be open to the public. It's a freebie. So y'all are welcome to come, and you're invited to go to that thing. I think it'll be a real blessing for you if you got nothing to do on a Saturday night, and you can bring a date, and it's just going to be a fun thing. So I haven't found necessary to have a drink since January 25th, 1981. And so I've been around for a while. And experience is a good thing. I know, what's that saying in Alcoholics Anonymous? The guy who's the most sober in the room is the one who woke up earlier. Anybody know that saying? Where they say if you got, like, you know, 2 weeks sober, but you woke up at 5 a.m., you're more sober than the... I don't know. I don't think so. there's a lot of this stuff, you know, the wisdom of the rooms, you know? The wisdom of the... You can stay sober on the wisdom of the rooms, you know, these sayings they come up with, you know? No, I think time in the crucible counts. I think, you know, it's nice to know a lot of stuff and memorize the big book and all that sort of stuff, but I'm saying, I think time in the arena, taking the pounding on the street, doing the wet work, getting slammed, getting the bounce checks, getting fired, having the broken relationships, being told you have cancer, going through everything you go through in the vagaries of life, the car accidents, everything that's going on, running the meetings, looking crazy, but trying not to drink and working these steps on the street, not knowing like you know anything you're doing, just panicking half the time. You know, they say there's a couple of things that human beings should never see. They should never see how sausages are made. You should never see how laws are made. And human beings should never see how people actually stay sober. It's such a scary deal, you know what I mean? So I think staying sober through life, as life is hitting you and disciplining you, he says that's how God disciplines us, okay? I think doing that for 10, 20, 30 years counts. I think it counts. I think it means something. I think that's where the rubber meets the road. I don't think this is a theory. I think it all takes place on the street, out there, after the meetings, when you're actually doing it, and it's 3 o'clock in the morning, and you're at home alone, and, you know, everybody's a worthless piece of crap because the world is closing in on you, and there's not enough money the month or whatever it is, and you don't know what you're going to do, and then the question's going to be, you're going to suck your thumb, you're going to cry, you're going to drink, or you're going to get up, read the big book, or you're going to pray to God. That's where it's all going to happen for you guys. That's where you're going to all change. That's where it's going to get serious. You know, a lot of people come in here and they stop drinking for a week or a month or 10 years or 15 years or 20 years. They go out again. A lot of people don't drink for a long period of time and they stay sober for 20 years and they're just dry and brittle and resentful and mad and angry and isolated and living lives of quiet desperation. The number of people that come in here and do that deal, you know, they talk about the big book, we've experienced much of heaven and we've been rocketed in the fourth dimension of existence of which we had not even dreamed. Those people, where they talk about in the big book, where the center point of their life is God, because he's come into their life and worked miracles that they couldn't do by themselves, those people are few and far between. Few and far between. And so I like to talk about emotional sobriety. Bill Wilson said it was the next frontier, I'm just going to share a few stories and a few experiences I had, some of which might actually have something to do with the fifth step, you know, something to do with having honest relationships with people, having something to do with becoming transparent. You know, the fifth step has to do with becoming transparent. Transparent among people. You know, it's important to be transparent. You know, when you're trans, you know, not being able to talk to people and explain to them who you are and what you are. I used to watch these people. Now I'm a trial attorney. In other words, for 35 years, I've been a trial attorney. I started off in the DA's office, and I was trying murder cases and all that stuff. I would stand before people trying murder cases and stuff like that, you know. I mean, that takes a little something. And yet, I would come into AA after trying, let's say, a murder case or a serious crime in front of a jury or, you know, in front of a gallery or something like that. And I would come to AA, and I would watch these guys for 20, 30 years talk extemporaneously without notes, without planning, about themselves and their lives, and I would sit there after being a trial attorney for many years and I'd say, how the hell does he do that? I could not do that. I couldn't do that. Remember, anybody see Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid? You know when they're being, I love that scene when they're being chased by the posse and they go all over the place, so up, down, through the rivers and everything, and they can't shake this posse, and there's a guy ahead of them, you know, some guy, Indian Joe or something like that, and Butch Cassidy or the Sundance Kid, I can never tell which one, Robert Redford, whatever, turns the other way, he says, could you do that? I couldn't do that. You know, they're like amazed at this guy. I would watch these guys. It says, if you want what we have and are ready to go to any lengths to get it, willing to go to any lengths to get it, then you're ready to take certain steps. And one of the things I wanted that these guys had was the ability to talk to themselves, maybe sometimes be self-deprecating, sometimes be funny, sometimes be serious, but they were being honest and sincere and talking about themselves and being genuine. You know, when you've lived a phony life, you know, one thing, if you're a phony, like I was a phony, okay? If you've been a phony and a bullshit artist all your life, the one thing you can recognize is phony bullshit artists. And that means you can also recognize the genuine article. And the genuine article floors you. Because you spend your entire life trying to suck up to people or manipulate them or name drop or say you're making $100,000 when you're making $3.50 or do whatever you have to do, whatever you have to do in order to say the thing or be the thing so people will like you. Because if you're an alcoholic, the one thing you realize is you're a piece of crap. You know what I mean? And they'd never like you if they really knew you, so you can never be you. And if you can never be you, that means nobody could ever really know you, so you're always alone anyway. And you don't even know you. And so you're not even transparent. So I'd watch these guys, you get up and they're like talking and they're not even running it through the filter like, well, what will they like this? Will they like that? Can I say this? Can I say that? You know what happens when you're new and, you know, I was new and you'd say something in a meeting and then for the next 10 hours you'd say, why did I say that? What are they thinking about me? I remember calling my sponsor 3 o'clock in the morning. That's what you do. You call him up 3 o'clock in the morning. He says, I can't sleep. He says, what's the matter? He says, well, I was at the meeting and I did this and I said that. And he says, yeah. And he says, I don't know. I was so stupid, and I know they think I'm crazy, and I know I did this and I did that. And he says, well, what did they say after the meeting? And I said, what do you mean? What did they say? What did they say? He said, well, they told me to keep coming back. He says, you know, Russ, I think they mean it. He said, you really do? He says, yeah, I think they mean it. I think they liked it. He said, really? He says, yeah. He says, I think they want you to keep it. I think it was okay. Really? I said, oh, okay, thanks. I went to sleep and I slept like a baby. Of course, he was probably up all night. But, you know, I mean, the fact of the matter, but listen, why does a 31-year-old man have to call up his sponsor because he can't get to sleep because he's turning over in his mind what he said that night with a bunch of alcoholics listening? It's because, and you know what that's it? You know what that is, by the way? That's alcoholism. That's why you drink. That's why I drank in the bars. That's why I drank around people. That's why they say fear of people will leave you. That's why whenever I had to be on a date or be with a woman or be with guys or do it, that's why I had to drink. Because I was scared of people and their judgment. I thought I was stupid. That's why alcohol. That's you see, alcohol is just a symptom of disease. The disease symptoms in the mind, not a body. And that's just one thing. There's a gazillion different things. What does it say? But you know, we're selfish, self-centered, selfishness, 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking. We step on the toes of others. That's part of that's something that has to do with alcoholism, the real alcoholism that doesn't go away like that just because you stop drinking. That's the thing that has you sitting in the audience looking at people that are doing stuff like this saying, how do they do that? I can't do that. Well, of course you could do that. The reason you can't do that is because you're alcoholic and you suffer from this disease and you can't do that with anybody. You can't even do it to yourself because you're telling yourself a lie most of the time. And so I'm 8 years old or I'm 9 years old and I'm down there on the baseball field in Great Neck, New York, and there's 18 kids and we're choosing up sides like, you know, kids do. You know, you got the two captains, they're the two really good guys on the team, and the only thing boys care about is how good you are in sports, and, you know, men are like that, they like sports stuff, you know, and so the two captains, Joe says, well, I'll take John, and the other one says, well, I'll take Jim, and he says, I'll take, anybody been involved in this, where the captains start picking up sides, and you know, you're in the middle there, and there's like 18 guys or 16 guys, and as they choose each one, the guy peels off and he goes to the team that he's supposed to go to until they have two teams. And I'm sitting there in the middle of the deal. And I'm praying. All I'm saying is, please don't let me be last. You know, to be picked second to last, was like for me to be picked first. I just didn't want to be the guy they hated the most. You know? And you know how they pick you. And it seems to me I was often that guy. And you know how they pick you. You're standing there in the middle and they're sort of laughing at you. And you know how what they say? They say things like, oh, do we have to take them? You know, it's almost like, that's how kids, it's almost like they would rather play with one less than, you know, have you on the team. Now, here's the interesting deal. You know, this is what would happen to me, because I now remember this. What would happen to me is I wanted to cry, I wanted to scream, I wanted to kill them, I wanted to blow up the field, I know I'm not God, because if I was God, they would all disintegrate. I wanted to do all that stuff. But instead of crying or running away or something deep inside of me told me that if I acted out or cried or anything, it would be worse. It would be worse. That the only thing I could do is make believe it didn't bother me. And so what I would find myself doing is, as they were laughing at me, I would start laughing too, like I was them standing over there laughing at, like it was like an out-of-body experience. I'm laughing along with them at me like it doesn't bother me. Make believe it doesn't bother me, because I know if I do that and I show it doesn't bother me, I'll be okay, I'll be safe. And so what I'm doing is I am actually acting, putting out there, I am acting completely different for everybody around me. I am playing a role completely different and putting out to you completely opposite of what's really actually going on inside. And I did that to protect myself, because somehow, some way, I was told that to protect yourself, you've got to sort of lie and make believe. Make believe you're not scared. Make believe they're not hurting you. Make believe they're not hurting your feelings. And how did I know that little wall that was maybe an inch thick, by the time I was 18, 20 years old, would grow to be 4 feet thick? So that it was so thick that no human being on the face of the earth could ever really know what was going inside of me. or why I was feeling the way I was feeling, or why I was doing the way I was doing. And even worse than that, I had no idea why I was feeling the way I was feeling or doing the way I was doing. I just knew I was doing it, and I had to do it, and I couldn't envision a life without drinking. And the only thing that worked was booze. And that's why I'm an alcoholic, because no woman, no car, no amount of money ever worked just as well as just a few drinks. And you know what it worked on? It worked on whatever that deal is that caused me to lie to you about me and laugh at me like I was one of you and building that wall. And I had to go 15 years to even get to the point, you know, the first step of getting out of jail is knowing you're in jail in the first place. And I had to go 15 years or 20 years to get to the point where I'd even admit that I had an alcohol problem. How many years did I have to go to admit that I had some sort of pride problem or there's something else going on in there? Because, you know, they say your alcoholic life seems the only normal one. So being like that, putting that out there, making believe, acting as if, is basically, that's what I feel comfortable with. Being that way, lying to myself and lying to you and phoning up and making believe, because if you're an alcoholic, you're also a please love me a holic, don't reject me a holic, I've got to stalk you a holic. It's any kind of holic you got to be. It's all that stuff, and we don't even see that stuff because that's just the way we are, because our alcoholic life seems normal and natural to us. So if it takes 15 years, you know, and 15 DUI arrests to realize that you have an alcohol problem, what does it take to happen in your life to realize you're like crazy in about 15,000 other different areas? And that's the real deal. And as a matter of fact, the alcohol was the only thing that made life feel okay, and I take away the alcohol, at least as if that's going to make a difference, and all it means is I get to experience alcoholism without any sedatives. Yeah, that works real good. And you know what you find out, what you find out interesting about this disease and about the quote program, is you find out sort of like that everything you're told to do in this deal. You know, I have a sign in my office, the truth will set you free. But first it'll piss you off. Then I have another sign that says, you know, from a few good men, the truth, you can't handle the truth. And what you realize is that everything you're told to do in Alcoholics Anonymous, almost everything you're told to do, is absolutely, completely opposite than what you think you should do. That's the crazy thing. You don't even realize that. You know, sometimes it happens slowly, sometimes it happens quickly, but what I find out is over a period of 30 years or 32 years, is also almost every, you know what it says, the grouch and the brainstorm is not for us. The brainstorm is not, I mean, I had incredible brain, because I'm brilliant. I had these brainstorms, it says the grouch and the brainstorm is not for us. My best thinking and my best day got me in here. You know, they, forget about the alcohol, you know, the first thing we're told, what's the first thing we're told in Alcoholics Anonymous? You got to stop drinking. I mean, how long does it take to figure out that stop drinking thing? Some people never figure it out. Then what's the next thing they do? You got to stop being angry. How's that one? You got to stop resenting. What do you mean? You know, how's that? You got to stop. How long does it take to the stop resenting thing? When they're begging to be resented, when they deserve to be resented, when you don't understand it wasn't my fault. You know how many times? I wish I had a dollar for every time an alcoholic says to a sponsor or anybody, "You don't understand." You don't understand. And then goes through a 20-minute story that's been keeping him drunk for 20 years about how he doesn't understand. That's why he beat up his wife, you know, because you don't understand. How many years does it take for an alcoholic to realize that resentments, even though they feel good, even though that's our normal way of doing, are anathema to us that will kill us, you know? Almost everything we're told to do, praying, believing in God, turning our life over, you name it, in Alcoholics Anonymous, when you examine it, it's completely opposite of the way we actually live our lives. As a matter of fact, in the big book, it says something cute like this. It says, ideas, emotions, and attitudes that are the driving forces of these men's lives are suddenly cast over to one side, and they become dominated by a whole new set of ideas, emotions, and attitude. Well, it's not even that. It's not a whole new set. It's a set that's completely opposite. It's almost like I've been driving through life in reverse. It's like I've been driving 100 miles per hour in reverse. And when things are going bad, I just step on the accelerator and go faster in reverse. And not only do you have to stop the car in reverse, you got to stop going forward, which seems so uncomfortable because I like driving while looking in the rearview mirror. It's like almost everything I'm doing that feels natural to me and feels good to me and comfortable to me that I've been doing all my life is the wrong deal. I mean, it's just incredible. I mean, when you're sponsoring, you sponsor a lot of people. You deal, you know what you deal with most of the time? People telling you crazy ideas that they want to do. Because it makes sense to them. Sober, sober. You know, the guys that call you up, you know, after they're like 3 months sober and, you know, they're starting to make their list or think about their lives, and they say, you know, 30 years ago in Brazil, when I was 19 years old, I left this gal standing at the altar with all her relatives and skipped out on the wedding. And I have to make an amends for that. So I bought a ticket. I know she's married and she has kids now, but I'm going to go down there and explain to her that I'm sorry. And listen to me. And that guy was sober and he had a brain and he had a job, and that made sense to him. That's how he read the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's how he read the 12 and 12. He was trying to do the right thing. That was his bright idea. And you know how many times I've heard something like that with a little bit of a twist or something from people in Alcoholics Anonymous because it seems so right to them. That's what they ought to do. Apologize, pick up the phone. And I said, listen, you really want to help her out? He says, yeah. Don't ever see her again. She's forgotten about you. She doesn't need you in her life. If God puts her, if God wants you to find her, you'll bump into her, you know, on Carl Way. You know what I mean? I say, oh, sorry. So, and you'll say, you know, Sally, you know, sorry about that dress thing and the, you know, whatever. Sorry about that marriage deal. You know, it didn't work out. So, you know, how do you get to the, you know, people will often say to me, you know, I say all these two terms, you know, how, why are you upset? You're upset because you're upsettable and all. And they say, well, how do you do that? How do you, you know, it's easy to say, and you can even see that. It's easy to say, how do you do it? How do you do it? Because you work these things through life while you're going through this, getting pounded, getting hurt, being told by people that are doing this thing, that are honest and have the capacity to be honest, being rebuked, being told that you're wrong. That's why sponsorship and having sponsors and having mentors that you love and you care about. And you know, the thing that almost killed me, you know what kills an alcoholic out in the street? One of the things that kills an alcoholic out of the street, you know how we say stay away from the bar, stay away from slippery places? The reason we say that is because, you know, most alcoholics, you know, we're sort of codependent. We want to be loved. You know, we're please don't reject me-aholics. We will do anything. We will prostitute ourselves in so many ways. You know, the old saying that I say, I've spent more money I don't have buying things I don't need, you know, to impress people I don't like, you know, and then complain at AA meetings that my credit card is maxed up on what? By this, by that, by the other thing, so that people will like me, because I know they won't like me because I got to have a haircut for them to like me, or I got to have a car to like me, or anything like that, because you don't think they're ever going to like me, like for me. I don't even like me for me. So if you don't even like you for you, if you hate you and you think you're a piece of crap, and you got the voice saying you're a jerk, you're an idiot, you ought to be dead, you ought to be, if that's your reputation with you, how are you going to live your life? How are you going to spend your money? How are you going to operate in life in order to fix that thing up? Exactly the way you've been doing it for 20, 30 years. And that's why you're in the jam you're in. That's why it's not working for you. Because you don't believe in you. You don't even like you, you know? You don't even think you're decent. You believe in cars and bars and money and skirts and Viagra and breast implants, breast enlargements and everything. You got a whole industry of people making billions of dollars off of the fact that you think you're pieces of shit. Because they're gonna inject something in you, and they're going to change something. You're going to do something in you so that you're acceptable to yourself and other people. And you'll never be acceptable because you wanted something. It's all vanity stuff. Just look at Ecclesiastes. It's all vanity. It'll never be acceptable because it's all an inside job and it can only be done by God. And you think you can do it with a few bucks and a plastic surgery. You know, all you have to do is look at the movie stars that are involved in this thing and the crap they get involved in to know that it doesn't, that fame and fortune, all that stuff and beauty doesn't solve the problem. Temporarily it will. But you know something? Scotch solved it temporarily. You know, I'm not saying plastic surgery. I'm not putting down somebody on plastic surgery. I'm not saying it won't solve something temporarily. I'm not saying that kind of stuff can't stop something temporarily. But how about a permanent fix? How about getting to the real problem kind of deal? How's that deal? You know, something so that you can be transparent and have friends and people, sincere friends and people, and be genuine with them, and not feel so alone because, you know, they know the worst about you or whatever. They know what's going on and you're not worried about it. I mean, you could probably get up in front of a group of a couple hundred people and talk quickly and, you know, because you don't have to run it through the, you know, what do they think about this and what do they think about that and just sort of say crap. Who knows? You know, but how do you do that? It takes time. It takes effort. It takes perseverance over a period of time, through trials, through stuff. Sometimes it takes being hurt. Sometimes it takes suffering and being hurt. That's the truth. You know, I was, one of the stories I tell, you know, I don't know whether it's a fifth-step story, a sixth-step story, a seventh-step story, what story, it doesn't matter, it's a story, because what you actually learn about this deal, you know, you could have a meeting with a few hundred people, and you could tell a story, and one person in the back could say, you know, somehow that enlightens him as to the third step, as the commitment to God. And you got another guy in the back that says somehow that enlightens him and it shows him something about the fifth step, about having transparent communications with other people and relationship with other people. And somebody in the back, the same story, the same meeting, it'll have something to do with the 12th step. And the truth of the matter is the steps and the principles of the steps and God's principles are embedded in every second of your life and everything you do. You know what I mean? There is no fifth step meeting or sixth step meeting or seventh step meeting because everybody here is at a different point in their life and when the pupil's ready, the teacher will appear. And for some people, there'll be one thing you'll walk out of this meeting and you'll get nothing. Except maybe 10 years from now, you'll remember something or something will hit you. You'll say, where did I get that? All of a sudden, it'll mean something to you. And some people come out of this meeting and they'll remember one thing. That's the only thing they'll remember and it'll change their lives and it won't even be something I said. It'll be something they think I said. And I'll get the credit for it anyway. And some people walk out of this meeting and it'll be a completely different thing. And it has more to do with what's going on inside of you and what you want and what your deal is. And so these steps are just sort of like exercises. They're spiritual exercises that sort of like really are telling us this is the way you need to live your life. This is the way you need to think. This is the way you need to act. These are the things you need to do. And they map it out in step form or in charts and things like that because we need that. You know why we need the charts? You know why we need this is the step, this is the exercise, this is what we do? Because on our own, we'd never do it. Because you know what we think? We think they're stupid. You know what it says in the Bible? It says to the carnal man, spiritual things are stupid. Listen, I'll tell you what. Any of you guys ever go out and try to tell your family and friends or people who are still drinking something about this program when they're not ready? You know what they think? They think you're stupid. They think you've got something that has saved your life, has changed your life, has changed. You have watched people, you have watched miracles happen around you. You are so excited about this, and there's some gal that's suicidal that's going down the tubes, and you go up there and you talk to her about it, you give her this gift of this thing that is changing people's lives, and she laughs at you like you're stupid. And you feel rejected. You say, doesn't she see? And she doesn't see. And they don't see. And you want them to see, you know, this deal. And so, but slowly but surely, if you immerse yourself in this thing, you start changing in your way of thinking. You know, things that sound stupid, sound crazy, all of a sudden they're not sounding so crazy. And all of a sudden you find, and even though you may be doing, there may be 300 things, for instance, that you need to change. 300 old ideas that you need to get rid of. 3,000 old ideas. 10 million old ideas. I don't know. There may be 300 old ideas that you just got to get rid of. I mean, forget about new stuff. Forget about learning new stuff. What about getting rid of the 300 old things that are holding you back? And that may take, what, 25, 30 years? Something like that? And then you're still holding on to some of them? What do you think? Like you walk into an AA meeting after 5 years or 10 years and all of a sudden you got rid of all those old ideas? How long? You may get rid of like 10 of those old ideas after 10 years and feel pretty good, but there's about 20 of them you're just hanging on to. And then after 10 years you get rid of another 10 and you feel a little bit better. You know, how long does it take to get rid of them? Forget about getting the new ideas that in your life that allow you to change and be a completely different individual. And the thing that used to hurt us out there, used to kill us is the slippery places thing. You know, why do they tell us stay away from slippery places, slippery people? Because you end up being, you're like a chameleon. Alcoholics want to be liked. They want to be loved. So you put me, listen, I'm an alcoholic. That was my deal. My drug of choice was booze. But listen to me, if I was at a pot party, I smoked pot. If they were doing cocaine, I did cocaine. You know, if I was in Margaritaville, Key West, I'm drinking margaritas. If I'm in a country and western bar, I'm drinking beer. If I'm in New York, in a swank place in New York, I'm drinking Manhattans or martinis. I never got them mixed up. You know, I never went to a country western bar and said, give me a margarita. You know what I mean? I'm looking to see what you're doing so I can fit in. Well, that same thing that used to kill me out there, because when you're a nothing, you see, when you're a nothing, you do all sorts of things. You don't even realize you're doing them because they just make you feel good. Like you talk bad about other people behind your back. Now, you don't realize that you're talking bad about other people behind their back because you feel crappy about yourself. You don't know. You don't realize. You see, alcoholics don't understand. When you hear somebody talking crap about somebody behind their back, what they're really saying is, I feel I'm a piece of shit. Because, you see, people that talk badly about other people behind their back think they're crappy, and if they can talk bad crap about other people behind that person's back and get the other person to agree with them, somehow it makes them feel better. If you can gossip about somebody and say negative stuff about somebody behind their back and focus on that person and get somebody else to agree with you, you feel good. It's like drinking. It's like that's why you do it. Now, you don't realize that's how you do it because that's your alcoholic life. That's just as much a part of alcoholism as anything else. Well, now you're going crap. No, you're going crazy because any self-respecting alcoholic now realizes he can't talk for the rest of his life. Because all you talk about is that gossip crap about other people behind their back. Now what am I going to say? Everybody talks about crap about other people. Look at The View. Look at this. Look at that. They all talk. Yeah, that's right. And you want to know something? You're right. The world does operate that way. So you got to decide whether you want what the world wants or what you want what these guys had when they talk about experiencing much of heaven being rocketed in the fourth dimension of existence. You got to decide whether you want to do what the world does. So these things are all counterintuitive. So when they're first foisted upon you, they do feel, you do have a tendency to be defiant and say, I don't want to go there. The truth will set you free, but first it'll piss you off, you know? The truth, you can't handle the truth. But the great thing is, the same thing that used to get me involved in the sickness, in other words, blending in with other people, wanting to be like other people, got me sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because I turned that really, like a judo thing, I turned it in my favor because it depends upon who you hang out with. Listen, guys, if you hang around with a bunch of guys that talk about getting laid, then that's what you talk about, that's what you think about, all you're doing is focusing on the gals, and that's your higher power, and believe me, you do believe in God. God is a woman. And your whole life is centered upon a woman, and you're going to reap the benefits of that deal, which ain't going to be pretty. And if you're a gal and all you do is talk about the men and blah, 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 whatever that is, you're going to reap the benefits of that deal. And if you hang around the men or the women in here and they're talking about focusing their lives on God and doing the stuff that happens, you may not like that thing. That's going to reap you certain benefits too. And whether you like it or not, over a period of time, you are going to be who you hang out with. I mean, the person you'll be in the next 5 years will depend upon the people you hang out with, the books you read, and the books you read will depend on who you hang out with. You're either going to be reading Vogue or Red Book or something like that, or Guns, or you're going to be reading other stuff that's going to feed you inside and change you so you're not even going to realize. So I hung around with these men, and I wanted them to like. Well, when you hang around with men, when you want what they have, and you won't get it, ain't late to get it, and you care about them, and you have a relationship with them, if you have a relationship with that kind of a man, I'm talking about men, the same thing with women, for me it's men, hang around with men, you're like your AA daddies or whatever it is, and you want them, you want their respect, there's something about you want them to respect you, you want to do the right thing by them, those men have a power. Because they have the ability to tell you something to your face that will hurt your feelings. And maybe even humiliate you. And you know what happens? Instead of walking away and yelling and screaming and saying, I'll get you, you can't do that to me. What will happen is because you love them and you want to be with them, you will, you ready for this? Change. You will change. You will change more than what a judge tells you. You'll change. That's what will happen. You change. It's an amazing, amazing thing. And I remember once I went to speak to a guy. I was, I don't even know, 5, 6, 7, 8 years sober. I'm not sure, 10 years sober. Father Al Grau. It was at a spiritual retreat. And at the Dominican retreat house. And I had something happening in my life that was killing me. I mean, I can't explain. Maybe you don't have to really explain it to alcoholics. I had something going on in my life, a situation. Now, I now realize that it wasn't the situation that was killing me, because I've had 1,000 situations like it since then, exactly the same, doesn't bother me at all, because that deal has been lifted from me. It wasn't the situation that was killing me. It was my pride, my ego, my fear that was killing me, so that whenever I ran into a situation like this, it was thumb-sucking time. It was thumb-sucking crybaby time. It was poor me time. You know what I mean? So what happened was, I ran into this situation that was a very, very difficult situation, which was driving me. I'd go to sleep thinking about it. I'd wake up thinking about it. I'd walk around the planet thinking about it. Do you know what? You ever have a situation where you can't stop thinking about it? And the more you think about it, the worse it gets? And you're trying to think of the answer? Because you know, if you think a little bit harder, because you know, you think you're addicted to drinking, how about addicted to thinking? What happens when you're a thinkaholic? When you can't stop the thinking? You know, if you can't figure out the answer to the question after the first 30 seconds, I got news for you. You ain't going to figure out that answer, even after 3 years of thinking about it, okay? Because the answer is going to elude you, because you have no idea what the answer is, so you just start thinking about it, and all you're thinking about is what's going to happen to you. What's going to happen to you if? What if this happens? What if that happens? What if the other thing happens? Do you know what that does to you if you're an alcoholic, even if you're sober? If you're thinking all the time about something that's going to scare the crap out of you, or something you're worried about, and there's no treatment, and there's nothing available, and there's nothing you can do about it, and you're feeling worse and worse, you know what that makes you feel like? Crap. Crap. And I couldn't talk about it in meetings. You know why, right? Why couldn't I talk about it in meetings? You know why? Well, because they wouldn't understand. Because if you're an alcoholic, when something's really bothering you, and it's really bad, and it's really embarrassing, and it's really humiliating, because you'll be humiliated because you've got to admit you're scared, but you don't even admit to yourself that you're scared, because it isn't you, it's them. It's not that you're scared, it's that he's an asshole. And how am I going to explain this at a meeting? I got 8 years. Because by that time I got 8 years, so you know what the 8 years does? It kills you. Then what happens is, the longer you're sober, the worse it gets. Because the longer you're sober, the more your pride comes into place. You say, well, I can't talk about this. I mean, I can't tell anybody about this because I got 8 years. I'm doing the step meetings. They think I'm good. What am I going to say? I'm sucking my thumb. And I'm sucking my thumb. Hey, come to my third step tonight. You know what I mean? And all of a sudden, I'm there alone with my thoughts. And my, as King David said in the Bible, he says, my bones are melting alone with my thoughts. I'm melting away. So I went to this retreat, not for any purposes of doing anything, just going to this retreat. And this thing had been bothering me for 6 months, and I couldn't get rid of it, and I couldn't tell anybody about it. And the guy who ran the retreat was a guy named Father Al Grau. And I'd gone through the steps many times, 8 years, a bunch of times gone through the steps, 4 steps and everything like that. And so I go to this retreat, and there's this guy, Father Al Grau. Never saw him before, never really saw him after that. He had been sober at that time, about the same time I am, around 32, 33 years, something like that. He was a war hero. He was a Jesuit priest. He was a psychologist, a doctor of psychology. He was one of the only survivors of the Bataan March. He was a prisoner of war. He was a war hero. This guy, he was like in his 70s or 80s at that time. This is the last retreat he was doing. I mean, he wasn't Jesus, but the closest thing there too. You know what I mean? And he was an alcoholic, and he was doing the retreat. And so I'm looking at this guy. I'm looking at the deal. Here he is, PhD in psychology, Jesuit priest, war hero, 1,000-mile Bataan march, you know what I mean? The whole bit, I'm saying, if anybody can help me, this guy, this is the guy. For 6 months, I've been dying with this thing. This is the guy. He's going to save me. So, anybody ever been to retreats? At the end of retreat, they have a thing where you can sign up and you can talk to the retreat master. So I sign up there, and I'm ready to go in there. I'm not even Catholic. I'm ready to go in there and confess. I'm going to do anything to get this thing off my back. And I walk in to see him, to his office, and I sat down and I, sort of introduced myself. My name's Russell. I got, 8 years and 10, whatever the heck I said. And I start telling him the story. And I get maybe 5 minutes into it. 5 minutes. Not even that. Maybe 3 minutes of the story that's bothering me. And he holds up his hand and he says, you ready? He says, I'm the wrong guy. I'm not the guy. I can't help you with this. I don't really want to hear it. I can't help you with this. Well, if you know anything about alcoholism, You understand, it didn't really matter whether he thought he was the guy or not. I had the hour, he was going to hear my story, you know what I mean? I was going to wrestle that sucker to the ground, you know what I mean? I'm like Jacob with the angel, you know, I'm gonna wrestle you, you're going to hear my story, you know? And so I'm going back and forth arguing with him. And the good news for me was is that he was sober. So, and I wasn't. I mean, I was physically sober, but I wasn't emotionally sober. So since I wasn't emotionally sober, I was willing to kill him and go to the death and commit suicide to get done what I wanted to get done. And because he was emotionally sober, he was willing to surrender and say, go ahead. You know what I mean? So I sort of won that battle, sort of. He said, hey, okay, go ahead. So I told him the whole story. Two or three times, you know, in Technicolor. And then after I was done, he said, you done? I said, yes. And I said, what do you think? What do you think? Because now I want the answer. And he told me the answer. You know what he said? This Jesuit priest, this psychologist, doctor of psychology, ran the West Palm Beach Institute for Drug and Alcohol Addiction. This is what he said to me. This is what came down from the mountain. He said, I'll tell you what I think. He says, I think you are full of shit. Well, yeah, you're laughing. You don't know what it's like. You don't know what it's like to bare your heart to somebody about something important that you haven't been able to talk about for 6 months and have the guy look at you and say, I think you're full of shit. You don't know what it's like. So listen, what do you think my reaction was? How about anger? How about disappointment? How about rage? And then he went on to explain to me in detail why I was full of shit. And you know, what happens if you're an alcoholic like me, as they're explaining to you in detail, you're full of shit, you're thinking of all the reasons why he's wrong and where he lives and how you're going to burn down his house. And then, of course, he ended the thing as a good Catholic priest. Well, then he says, you know, he genuinely says, go and love my... You know, he did one of those things, you know, I love your brother, go and love, or something like that, and then kicked me out of his office. And so as I'm walking back to my room, which is this little room, all they gave you is a little cot with like a little cross on the above the cot. And as I'm walking back to my room, all I'm thinking is somebody ought to report this guy to the Vatican. Because I'm not Catholic. I know if you do something wrong, you say something, I think they tell you to do 5 Hail Marys, or maybe you read a verse, you do something. I don't think a Jesuit priest, I don't think they're supposed to say you're full of shit, you know what I mean? But unfortunately, I had a recovered alcoholic priest, you know. I had an alcoholic priest who was used to working with alcoholics, you know. For regular people, you say 5 Hail Marys. With alcoholics, you say you're full of shit. Because that's the screwdriver, that's the thing, that's what we understand. We understand the hammer over the head, the car crash, the explosion, the 15 years in jail. That's what we understand. Oh, that's what you meant. And so that's what we think of. That's what gets our attention. Our attention is not getting by people who like us. We give attention to people who don't like us. We don't sit around and think about all the people that love us and like us and are telling good things. We shit on them. We think about all the people that hate us and what we can do to change to make them like us. It's pain that's the motivator with us. That's why in the sixth step they say suffering. We learn the great value of suffering. Suffering is what moves alcoholics, which is the one thing we do what? That's the only thing that really changes us, and that's the one thing we try to do what? Avoid. So the only thing that changes us and turns you into a man or a woman who's worthwhile, you run around the planet trying to make sure it never happens to you. And stay sicker and sicker and sicker. And make sure you never get sponsored or hang out with people that are going to tell you you're full of shit. Make sure you only hang out with people that will make you feel good. And that way, you'll always feel good, you'll always act out, you'll always be an idiot, and you'll never have to change. And if you drink, you can blame it on AA. So then I go back to my room. And, of course, I'm thinking, you know, somebody ought to tell the Vatican, this can't be right. Love and tolerance is our call, you know, our code. You know what I mean? We're tough on ourselves. We're easy on others. I'm thinking of, you know, because I got 8 years and I know everything. And, you know, I know whatever he did was wrong, you know. And, you know, I'm stopping guys. I'm stopping guys as they're going. He says, you know that priest in there? He says, yeah, Father Alvin. He says, don't see him. He's crazy. You know what I mean? I'm like, to every person I meet, they says, he's crazy. Don't see him. I'm warning you. And I sit down in my bed, and you know what I'm doing? I'm still thinking. You know, I'm doing what you would be doing. I'm thinking. He said this, and I said that, and he said this. You know how you do that thing? 15 times he said this, I said that. And then you start making believe that you actually said something else, and what you should have said, and what you could have said, and what he said. And then you think about burning his dog, and shooting his wife, and killing, chopping off his head, and stuff like that, You know, the kind of stuff. Well, you're laughing. You don't know what it's like. Obviously, we suffer from different kinds of alcoholism. But in any event, you think about all the nasty. And then, so I'm sitting there thinking about this thing because it was like an explosion that went off in my head. And all of a sudden, a thought went through my head. This is what happens. This is how Alcoholics Anonymous works. This is how God works. This is how this program works. 8 years of reading the big book. 8 years of going to meetings. 8 years of listening to the sponsors. 8 years of dealing with this stuff, and I hadn't learned this lesson. Whatever the lesson was, I hadn't learned it. Because it was destroying my life, and it was making my life unmanageable. Whatever that lesson was, I hadn't learned it. And it was destroying me. And I was being disciplined, and I don't like being disciplined. And I was being hurt, and I don't like being hurt. And I'm sitting there, going through this thing, in my mind, what Al Grau said, and what happened, and everything that came up, everything I've learned over 8 years came up right there, and going through my mind, and all of a sudden this thought goes through my mind. It's a scary thought. And the thought said something like this. Maybe he's right. Oh, man, that's whoa. Now, if you don't have the capacity to be honest, you'll never have that thought. But if you're one of those alcoholics with the capacity to be honest, it may take 8 years, it may take 20 years, it may take a lot of means and a lot of stuff, but eventually, one day, something will happen, it'll be like that, and all of a sudden the thought will say, maybe he's right. And then you know what the next thought was? He is right. Everything he said made sense. He's absolutely right. That's the problem. And something that had been bothering me for 6 months went away. I never thought about it again. And that same situation has happened to me for the last 20 years, and it's never even bothered me. And the thing that was hurting me in that situation, which really had to do with worrying about what other people think about me, had to do with people pleasing. What it really had to do with is living up to other people's expectations about me when I didn't get them in the jam in the first place. It had to do with alcohol. When you're an alcoholic and you're an addict and you're involved in this deal, you will run into a lot of alcoholics and addicts that are also involved in this deal. And you'll try to help them and you'll try to do the right thing. And what you don't realize is that alcoholics and addicts are not nice people. Now, I can tell, I'm not talking about you guys. You guys are obviously, it's pretty obvious to me that you guys are wonderful. But I'm talking about over at the car room, they're pretty nasty. You know what I mean? Alcoholics and addicts are nasty, sort of selfish, self-centered people. That's why they have this thing called Al-Anon. These are people that have to go to meetings for the rest of their lives because they actually met us at an elevator or something, You know what we do? We crap on people, we hurt people, and then we think it's their fault, and then we yell at them, and we make them feel like they have to fix us, and if they don't bail us out and everything, they should feel guilty about it. That's what alcoholics and addicts do. And if you happen to be one of those people that feel kind of crappy about yourself anyway, you'll get yourself in the jam and start thinking that you have to fix somebody and make somebody all good or something's wrong with you and something bad's going to happen to you. And even after 8 years, I worried a lot about what other people thought about me. Now, of course, you can get over the other side where you don't ever think about how you're dealing with other people and then you're like a sociopath. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about somebody who is constantly focused, almost obsessively, on what does the group think, what do they think, what does this one think, and all that sort of stuff, where it sort of terrorizes your life. They're living rent-free in your head. And that's what Al Growl was talking to me about. He was talking about you're full of shit. You're basically worrying about somebody that you had nothing to do with getting him in this jam. If he didn't get caught, you understand what I'm saying? You wouldn't even know who he is. If he goes away for 20 years or 30 years, you're going to do the best job you can. That's not your fault. It's his fault. He's the one who sold the cocaine. He's the one who did the deal. He's the one who did this stuff. You're not responsible for that. And I didn't know that. It's like, how long it takes you to learn that all your responsibility is to try to carry the message? You don't even have to carry the message. You may be sponsoring somebody and you worry, you spend all night sucking your thumb saying, when is he going to get it? When is she going to get it? Why did she go out and drink? It's not your concern. You just try to carry the message. Try to carry the message. You know something? Whether they get it or not, it's their concern. You don't have to feel like you did something wrong. You can't do anything wrong. Alcoholics are like cockroaches. After the thermonuclear blast, they're going to still be alive, you know? Nothing can harm an alcoholic. You can't hurt an alcoholic. They're indestructible. And that, because that guy had the ability to tell me I was full of crap and say that to me, something that had been bothering me for my entire life just left, you know, just like gone, you know. That's the power. That's the power of a fifth step sort of relationship. That's the power of a relationship among people, you know, where the truth is being told, even if one person, you know why? Because he was sober. And because he was sober, he was not worried about what I thought about him. You see, if he was not so sober, he wouldn't have told me I was full of crap. He would have tried to, quote, help me. He would have tried to love on me or be my friend, because he would have been thinking less about helping me, you know, and turning me around, and more about, well, if I say this, will Russ be mad at me? Will he talk about me? And, you know, he made a decision. You know, this guy may hate my guts. You know, he may not like me. He may talk to everybody in this place and sound the worst, but you know what? But I'm going to tell him the truth. And the truth is, you want to know something? You're a scared little puppy dog. You're full of crap, and you want to grow up. I mean, you're 30-something years old. When the hell are you going to grow up? I'm going to tell him the truth because I love him so much, he deserves the truth, even if he doesn't like me. And I walked away not liking him, and all I do now is talk about him all the time, which is all the other guys in my life, that, you know, the guys like this that I talk. You understand what I'm saying? And that's the kind of relationship you have with people when you're doing fifth-step communications. You know what I mean? And that's the kind of power those kind of communications can have over an individual, over your life. That's how it can change your life. You know, I'm not talking about sitting in the bar and saying, how about those dolphins? That's not going to change your life. I'm not talking about sitting in the bar and saying, look at that blonde. Man, she's really sad. That's not going to change your life. I'm not talking about the conversations you have during the day all the time, none of which is going to change your life except for the worst. I'm talking about that kind of conversation, that kind of serious conversation where the truth is being spoken about. And even though I wasn't speaking the truth, I was speaking the truth. I just didn't know I was unfortunately speaking the truth to somebody who actually saw the truth. He saw the truth, and the truth was, you see, I was trying to explain to him, it's not to blame, it's not my fault, I'm caught in a situation, bad breaks and misunderstanding, why is this happening to me? You understand, I'm really the hero, I'm the good guy, I'm caught in a situation, I'm a victim. And he saw the truth, and the truth was I was full of shit, and I was acting like a 2-year-old, and it was time to grow up. Never tell the truth, never take a chance to tell the truth to somebody who can actually see the truth, because they may tell you the truth. That's what a fifth step is all about. Now that you've done your fourth step, now you're going to tell somebody the truth. And some people are just not going to do it because they'd rather live a life of quiet desperation. It's like the sixth step we're going to get into like next week, where they did the separation that separates the men from the boys. We all get separated out. But you know, the truth is, this is not a dress rehearsal. You're going to get what you pay for. You're going to get what you surrender. You're going to get out of this what you put into this deal. So next week we'll talk about step six. Thank you.